Thank you, Bob, and thanks, everybody, for being here. Thank you to the council for inviting me. I appreciate it very much. To all of you who just got your food, manja, eat. I will say that I'm not just a fan of cooking shows, but I love Bobby Flay's barbecue stuff. Man, every time I come to Kansas City, I feel like I'm leaving at least 5 pounds heavier. I have to stop stuffing barbecue in my face. But it is great to be back here, and it's great to be with all of you. First of all, I want to recognize Kyle Brooks, who is my great Region 7 administrator right here. As all of you know, he's from this area, and he has the nicest way about him to get into issues and to do it in a way that's non-confrontational, that's collaborative, that it's in everybody's best interest, and that's exactly the kind of attitude that EPA needs to have every day. So you're a great representative of the agency, Kyle. I thank you for all that. And I know I have Ken Kaposis here, who's doing much of our major work in the water program, and Arvin Gannison, who works with me on these policy issues. And we're all here because we know that we have things to talk about. We have some serious things to talk about. Well, yesterday I was in Columbia, and I was touring a farm that's owned by Bill and Judy Heffernan. And it's a 500-acre farm, and I got a chance also later in the day to sit down with some farmers in the area in a roundtable discussion. And the Heffernans were so great and gracious for having us, and I just can't thank them enough. And it was one of sort of many farms that I am trying to go out and about lately to let people know that even though I'm from Boston, I'm getting these issues. I'm getting out so I understand them. Obviously, I do recognize that not all farms are the same, but I had a really cool experience yesterday. And I understand that what farmers grow and the scale and the size of farms vary. But what I saw on Bill Heffernan's face as he was talking about all the work he's doing on his farm to be the best steward he can be was really a common thread that I have seen in every farmer's eyes. When I go out and about. I remember one of the first trips I had with Kyle, we went to the Iowa State Fair, and I will never forget a farmer who came up to me and the pride in his eyes when he told me that his son finished college and he's going to come back and join the farm. Those are sort of priceless pieces of information for me to leave with, to recognize just how important these issues are and why they're always personal. And I know that, and I'm beginning to understand the kind of conversations we need to develop the relationship I want to have between EPA and the agriculture community, because we are really moving forward to deal with some difficult issues. Nothing's ever easy, but if we work together, I believe that we can make substantial progress and develop the kind of trusting relationship that you expect to have with an agency whose purpose is public health and environmental protection, which is frankly what the agriculture community has also been all about. So it's a wonderful opportunity. But today, let me get into some of the details. Today I'm here to talk about the Clean Water Act proposal, which was a proposed rule that was really generated because the Supreme Court told us we had to take some action. State organizations told us, numerous agriculture stakeholder groups told us, and the aim of the proposal and the reason why we need to take action is to really clear up some legal confusion and so that we can properly protect waters that are actually vital for public health. And we had to do it in a way that used sound science so that we could get our job done. And we also know that part of that challenge was to do this in a way that would keep farmers and ranchers and the ag industry as a whole doing what they do best, which is to produce the food, fuel, and fiber that really provide for our American way of life that we also cherish. The kinds of water bodies that we need to protect under the drinking water, for drinking water, really impact 1 in 3 Americans. And right here in Kansas, at least 9 in 10 residents get their drinking waters from these small sources. smaller waters that feed these larger sources. That's why we're doing the waters of the U.S., because I want to know and you want to know what water is necessary to protect drinking water supplies, to keep our natural resources healthy, so that we can all go about our business recognizing what needs special treatment and recognizing the waters that you don't need to hear from EPA or the Army Corps or anybody else about. But I know that no one understands the importance of water quality better than the agriculture community. I know it, and I'm learning it every day. You're the standard bearer for stewardship of our nation's land and water, while growing a farm economy that is the envy of the world. And so I should stop there and just say a couple of words, and they are thank you. Thank you for myself and for my family and for all of the work that you do. Now, we know we have to take action. We know we had to propose this rule, and we know we have to finish it. But while we have taken action to put a proposal out, we're unfortunately having to deal with misinformation that is really becoming the story. Whether that's legitimate confusion or not, we have to address it. And that's what today is all about. We're going to try to deal with the misinformation that none of us needs to worry about so that we can deal with the legitimate issues and concerns and make sure that they become the front seat instead of the back seat in our conversations. Now, we have to change the idea that EPA and the agriculture community can't come to an understanding about what waters need to protect it and how to do it in a way that keeps our farms and ranchers and our silviculture working the way that they have to. But I know in DC that what I'm hearing out there is that our new rule will shut down July 4th fireworks. I trust that did not happen. Let's get beyond that one. I also heard that we're trying to regulate rain in puddles and driveways and in playgrounds. Well, we know that none of that is true. But today and yesterday, here in the heartland, it reminded me how nice it is to be out of DC and talking to real people about real issues. Because you know what? 4th of July fireworks didn't come up. Puddles and playgrounds didn't come up. Folks came to a round table with me yesterday. They came there to express their real concerns with the proposed rule. And we were able to have real conversations about really important things. Those are the conversations that EPA is going to show up for every time. And those are the conversations that we really need to have. And I think it was a really big step forward. We've ditched those myths. And we've talked about the issues that matter to all of us. And we need to keep it up. We need to keep it up until I have a final rule that you are going to be just as proud of as I am. While EPA feels confident that under this proposal, we are going to be actually identifying fewer waters that are jurisdictional than under President Reagan. But you know what? That's not giving anybody comfort. You know why? Because they need to know what this on-the-ground needs means for farmers and ranchers today. They don't frankly care what happened in the Reagan administration. They care what's happening today and what they can expect if this rule moves forward for their livelihood. And we're beginning to identify those concerns and those questions, and we're going to answer each and every one of them. Now, we all know and we all agreed yesterday and will continue to agree that people have a right to a healthy land and they have a right to clean water. So we need to make sure that the protections that EPA is putting into place are reasonable, that they're consistently implemented. That's how to make sure that everyone is playing, that everyone is facing the same playing field, and that you can operate your businesses with confidence and certainty. And all of us also know that we need to rely on the science and we need to rely on accurate facts. So there's lots of things that we can agree together. So it's great that now that we agree to all those premises, we can begin to talk and roll up our sleeves and talk about things that really matter, to both you and EPA, and we can make sure that we work together to the benefit of both producers and public health. Well, yesterday, I heard very clearly some of the concerns about our proposed rule. I heard that everybody is fearing that EPA is regulating groundwater, and this is simply not true. Groundwater regulations do and will fall under the purview of the states. This rule will not change that. EPA is not regulating lands or activities in all activities in floodplains. And we're not regulating every puddle, dry wash, or erosion feature. In fact, we're attempting here to do just the opposite. And believe me, if cattle are crossing a wet field, don't get in their way. Let them cross it. It's perfectly okay. You know why? Because they know that that's a normal thing that happens on a farm. And I know that normal farming practices, and all normal farming practices, remain exempt in this proposed rule just as they were before. We have not proposed to change any of that. Now, on the Heffernan's farm, which was why it was great to be there, we saw lots of collection ponds, we saw terraces, we saw other conservation practices, and all of them were actually extraordinarily good for the farming he wants to do. But the most important thing for me was that they're also tremendously good for water quality and water protection. And guess what? None of what he was doing required a permit from EPA. And we're not talking about changing that either. Now, the bottom line is, if a farmer or a rancher didn't need a permit before, if this rule moves forward as proposed, it won't then. It will not require a permit. But I know that in between now and then, we have a long discussion that we need to have together. For example, we had Bill Heffernan. He had a pond that actually was jurisdictional because it was connected to this larger water system, and it did require protection. But he didn't need to have a permit for it. He didn't even have a permit for it because he wasn't doing anything like filling it, and he wasn't inserting pollution or pollutants into that water. He did not need a permit. So what are we doing about ditches? I heard a lot about ditches, way more than I ever thought I would talk about ditches. I very seldom use the word ditch since I was a little kid, when we used to ditch one another, if you remember those days. It is amazing to me how difficult it's been to define what ditch we care about in all the many ditches we don't. So let me give a shot at it. Take a shot at it. Water from these very, very small sources are things that we care about and that we have to deal with. But we don't have to deal with every ditch. EPA is not saying that ditches are jurisdictional. In fact, our proposal specifically says that we're not regulating all ditches, unlike current existing regulations, which don't make that clarification. Why did we do that? Because while some ditches are actually connected to larger water systems and are therefore jurisdictional, because they're vital to public health and to water quality, the vast majority of ditches simply aren't important from a water quality perspective. I don't want to deal with them any more than you want me to deal with them. Most of them don't look and act and feel like a stream. If they don't, then they're not important. We can take them off the table. Help me put that into language that provides surety that that's what I'm going to be doing moving forward, is getting most of them out of the way and dealing with the ones that really matter. But keep in mind, and this is very important, that up to 117 million people rely on waters that only run seasonally, as opposed to waters that run 24 hours of every day. That is simple fact. So if your ditch looks and acts like a stream, it may need protection even if it doesn't run every season. It still may need protection. That doesn't mean you need to have a permit just to have it run through. What it means is you should take care of that, recognizing that it is vital to public health. That's all that we are attempting to do here. So let's talk about one more thing, and then I want to get to questions and answers, because I know that's when we can have a much better dialogue. Let's talk about the interpretive rule, because I have never proposed anything that I thought would be so well received as this that has fallen totally flat on its face. So we need to talk about this, because I need to understand from you where we went wrong and what we need to do moving forward. Now, the interpretive rule identified 56 conservation practices that EPA really thought, working with USDA and NRCS, we should really highlight because they are very cool. They are not only new conservation practices that are helping people maintain their farms in a way that prevents erosion, in a way that keeps soil intact, but they are also ways of protecting water quality, because science now tells us that those are exactly the type of practices that will keep our water bodies clean and protect our drinking water supply. So the interpretive rule was really an effort to highlight these as being great things to do to make sure that you never had to worry that EPA would come a knock-in if you utilized any of those practices. So the 56 practices are really an attempt to clear the path for what we think of as slam dunk conservation practices. They were not an attempt, or in any way would they, narrow the exemptions that are currently in place for agriculture. The 56 were a subset of those that we wanted to call attention to and highlight, and we put it in a separate rule so we could keep adding to it. Because I don't want to reopen Clean Water Act rules every time we find something really cool that we want to identify that would like people to think about doing and realize that they can do it without communicating with us, without communicating with the Army Corps, without communicating with NRCS. They are very good farm practices to move forward. But some of them have missed, some folks, when they read it, clearly thought we were trying to narrow the exemption, and only if NRCS somehow approved something would it ever be recognized as a normal farming practice. That was not the intent. That was not the intent. Some people have thought that it meant that we were adding federal standards that had to be complied with. That was not the intent. Conservation standards that we have identified are not federal regulatory standards. They provide a roadmap for producers in a way that we hoped would encourage their use. So these exemptions really we saw as being always self-implementing. Just practices that are clearly identified, which means that you don't need to double check with anybody at the federal level at any time if those practices are being considered. Now, I'm sure that everyone here can agree, and frankly, everyone that we interact can agree, that the best discussion on jurisdictional determinations is the one that actually never needs to happen. That's the goal. That's the goal. So we've worked on these issues together, and I know that we have challenges ahead, but frankly, I remain tremendously optimistic. I've been optimistic because I know that we have folks at the table who need to be at the table. Farmers and ranchers and those who are really providing us the kind of on-the-ground concerns that we need to address moving forward. And in the end of the day, I know that we can all agree that we don't have to sacrifice sensible environmental protections in order to have a strong farm economy. We know that. We know that that's the case. Conservation leadership on ag lands has an incredible ripple effect that we really want to take advantage of. That's why farmers and ranchers enjoy a close relationship with sportsmen and wildlife conservation groups like Ducks Unlimited. Those folks care about this issue, and they want this issue resolved, and they want a rule that's strong enough that allows them to maintain the strong relationship they have with the agriculture community moving forward. You know, the U.S. outdoor industry relies on water just the same way you do and our families do. And they account for more than $640 billion in direct consumer spending every year and 6 million jobs. That's why they care about this issue, so that we all have a level playing field, so that we can all continue to do the work that we have to do and do it in a way that consistently and effectively protects water supplies that they care about. That's why local mayors and officials have really been actively engaged in these discussions, because they see there's opportunities for us to do things better, to rely on the science, to be as flexible as possible, but to deliver the kind of reductions that the Clean Water Act intended. Now, if we can clear things up, I think we can clean things up. We can cut red tape, we can cut costs to taxpayers, we can cut down on the frustration, and oh yeah, we can provide clean drinking water consistently for those 117 million people that understand the need to protect these small water supplies because they rely on them each and every day for themselves and their families. In total, we can deliver lots of opportunity for continued operation of our farms and our ranches, and do it in a way that provides significant benefit to the general public. So I think I should stop there, other than to remind you that we've worked together on a lot of thorny issues. You know, we have worked together on farm equipment emission standards. You have stepped up each and every time to address those issues. We have worked together on safer pesticide use. Nobody has shied away from the table to tell us what they think and how we should be doing this. And each and every time, we have worked through those issues together. We have to take that same collaborative partnership approach with this rule as we have every other challenge that we have faced together. We know that we have relied on your ingenuity as well as your patience and your grit. If anyone can do this with us, you can do this with us. I am sure of it. We have passed landmark laws to protect the water we drink and the air we breathe, and we know that it requires our agriculture community to be at the table, bringing their smarts and their skills so that we can figure out how to do this well. So let's commit from this day forward to focus on facts. Let's commit to getting at the table and rolling up our sleeves. I will commit to you that if you raise an issue of concern, I will address it. If you want us to think differently about how this rule is structured and the interpretive rule, I am not wedded to process. I only want outcomes, just like you. So let's figure out how we work together for the benefit and the promise of the American people. We can deliver them the protections they're looking for from EPA while we continue to have a strong, robust farm economy. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Madam Administrator. I've got an hour and a half's worth
of
questions
here. All right,
we're
ready. Everybody keep sitting.
Some of these are going to sound pretty familiar, okay? And my compliments to some of my colleagues who have put a lot of thought into framing these, so hopefully we won't have a lot of repetition. Number one, EPA states the proposed WOTUS rules will not add to or expand the scope of waters historically protected under the Clean Water Act. While EPA considers these historically covered waters, the agency agrees they are officially being defined for the first time by rule, and that definition includes ephemeral streams.
Yes.
Some feel, therefore, that states may not have any choice but to expand its list of classified protected waters due to citizen lawsuits. For example, Missouri has a history of citizen lawsuits being filed against EPA and forcing Missouri to consider expanding.
That's a long question. Let me get a pen.
I'll share it with you here.
No, that's okay.
It is a long
one. I got it.
Okay. Force. Thank you.
Thank you, Will. It was a trick.
Okay. Of citizen lawsuits forcing Missouri to consider expanding the waters covered under the CWA. Take a crack.
Okay. I hit a little bit of this in my earlier speech, but let me hit this again. We actually don't believe we are expanding jurisdiction. But belief is not what I'm asking you to worry about. I'm asking you to look at the words, and I'm asking you to look at the statute, and I'm asking you to look at the regulations, and we'll look at them together. I don't expect that you're going to believe. I expect that you're going to want to see it, right? This is sort of near a show-me state, right? Yeah, there you go. So in terms of jurisdiction, one of the things that I realized over the past couple of weeks is that there was... There's a lot of education that needs to go back and forth. Is we need to explain to you what the actually existing rules are more effectively so you can understand that this is a jurisdictional rule, not a permit determination. And so a lot of things that we're talking about and we're defining are things that actually have been jurisdictional all along. And ephemeral streams are one of them. I explained to you that in order for a water to be jurisdictional, it really has to have an opportunity to have a significant impact on these downstreams. But I've also explained to you that a lot of our drinking water supply, maybe one out of three people, rely on these streams that don't run all the time in order for their drinking water supplies. So there is an opportunity for us to sit down and understand what has been jurisdictional, how we're reflecting this in the new rule. Now, the other issue that you raised is one that actually we heard again yesterday, which was what do these definitions mean for states who really are our primary regulator of water in all of these states? We are actually pulling together a group of states who can sit down with us and explain whether or not we should have had other considerations and what those were and how we understand the implications on the states if we have not fully understood it already. We're going to do that. That is something that's front and center. And the last thing on citizen lawsuits is where citizen lawsuits come in as being important for everybody is when the EPA and the Army Corps it may not be clear about the jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act, which means there's a gray area in which citizen suits can operate. That gray area is very large right now. And what this is trying to do is actually close that area, make it narrower. There will be issues that you cannot nationally decide because the science isn't strong enough, and you have to actually go to the site and take a look. That's how best you do it. And that will continue, but we're trying to be better than that and narrow the gray areas as much as we can. Your help with that will be important, and it will narrow the opportunity for citizen suits. One of the reasons why we did the interpretive rule and identified those 56 was exactly the reason you're talking about. Because if we put those there, we're saying EPA thinks those are good. We're saying the Army Corps thinks those are good. And it provides you better certainty moving forward that if that's the kind of activity and practice you want to do, that it is not just normal farming practices, but it's practices that are going to improve water quality. And that's what we kind of, the signals that we're trying to send.
Very good. Yeah, thank you. Very good. Here's a short one.
Oh, good.
And it probably covers much of the same ground, but it's very, very well said. On my farm is a small depression that catches rainwater. Overflow enters and passes through three farm ponds before entering a tributary creek. Why is this catch basin to be considered to be waters of the U.S.?
I don't know that it is. Is that a good enough answer?
No.
Okay. Anybody else want to answer it? Kyle, Ken?
I would say, based on the description of what Mr. Peterson read out there, that would not be considered jurisdictional today, and it would not be considered jurisdictional under the proposed rule.
That's a better answer. Can you explain, Ken?
Well, the reason is that the way it was described is that it's an area in the field that occasionally collects water because that's what the low areas in the field do, is that they collect water. Then often that water, it drains off into somewhere else. And the mere fact that it drains off into another catchment area or pond or whatever that still sounds as though that is not jurisdictional. The rule is not anticipating that you would be looking at trying to see how many water bodies you could connect the dots to get to the end of the line. Because we're talking about waters that individually or collectively have a significant impact on those downstream waters. We're not talking about, and that it would have to be a downstream water that's a traditionally navigable water that's jurisdictional. So you would not be looking to see just simply connecting, as I said. You don't just connect the dots through a series of non-jurisdictional waters to get to a point where you say, I'm going to link them all together and I'm going to say they're jurisdictional.
That was the puddle issue? Okay.
That was puddles. Okay, different question. Question on section 402. Assuming there are jurisdictional waters on a farm, how will activities like spraying pesticides and applying nutrients near and around a jurisdictional water be regulated? Will there be required permitting?
I think we all know that when you apply pesticides directly to water, that there is a general permit that covers that activity. So the answer is I'm not aware of any new permitting requirements that will be generated under this proposed rule. That was a shorter answer. That was a good one.
Let me just follow up on the same topic. Please share how new definition of WOTUS may change permits for water and wastewater and CAFO.
I don't believe there's any change.
Let's talk about ditches.
Okay.
I've heard more about ditches than I have, and I grew up on a farm but it's been a long time ago. You state the proposed WOTUS rules will not increase regulation of ditches. The proposed rule leaves it to the agency's best professional judgment to make determinations as to what flood interval to use for determining floodplains and determining less than perennial flow, which are some of the necessary criteria for determining whether a ditch is exempt. With literally millions of unique features and floodplains everywhere, how does EPA propose to have enough professionals to provide their best judgment?
Actually, we don't. That's not how it works. We don't anticipate that the process of looking at whether or not something that is in this gray area is jurisdictional or the process of getting a permit changes at all. That continues to be the process. And what we're trying to do is actually solicit comment on these definitions so that we can make them as crisp and clear as possible so that we minimize the kind of case-by-case review that's necessary. But I think you all know that thousands of permits are issued every year. Many of those permits require somebody looking at it and going, yep, I get it, okay, and you're off. And so we don't expect that to change at all. What we're asking you to do, however, is to look at our definitions to make sure that we have narrowed this as much as we can, that it makes sense to you, and that it helps to make those case-by-case reviews as low resource needs as possible, because we really do only want to address attention when it is a significant source of potential impact that we're talking about. And so take a look at the proposed definitions. If you think that there's ways in which we can narrow that or make that more certain, we'll certainly bring the Corps and EPA together to figure out how we do that.
Very good. I know we're running tight on time, but we're going to try and squeeze in two more questions
okay. If
we can. Farming activities like deep ripping have been excluded.
Lord.
Oh, is this a Ken question? Have been excluded from the normal farming exemption under Section 404, this thus requiring a permit. Do you expect other tillage activities to also require a permit?
If it's been a normal farming exemption under Section 404, it will still be a normal farming exemption under Section 404.
Yeah. And I think in the question on deep ripping, The reason that the deep ripping has not been considered a normal farming exemption is because of the operation of the normal farming exemption in the way the statute has read, in that it converts a water into a non-water. And so that's the reason why the agency has taken that position over the years, because that's what the statute gives us the responsibility to do, or the authority. That's the way that Congress defined the exemption. So, but that is not likely to change.
Well, let me tell you what he just said, and that is, this is the way that it works. If it's defined in the statute as explicitly as that, then that is the rule of the game that we have to live by. The rules themselves can't change that. The rules do not change the statute, they interpret them, and they actually implement them. So it's important to remember that if this is a concern, that we work as best we can together, but we cannot change the statute with the rule.
Last question. EPA states the proposed WOTUS rules do not regulate activities on land. Some disagree, stating the proposed rule will guide all sections of the Clean Water Act, including Section 303 and water quality standards. They feel the regulatory activities on land will be of the nature now seen in the Chesapeake Bay, where EPA, along with willing states, are adopting restrictive land use policies in order to impose a TMDL on land within the Bay watershed. Your response?
We still are convinced that we have not opened up the door to regulating land practices, and we need to figure out how how you're reading it and how we can best understand the concerns and respond to them. We know what we intended with this. We need to make sure that the language is as clear as it can be and that these types of pretty large, what we think of as misreading of the